This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel, and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
And we're live.
Happy Sunday, everybody. Happy Sunday, everybody. We're gathered here today. But those who believe in a geocentrist and those who believe in a heliocentric model to witness yet another debate on the shape of our world. This debate will feature two very prominent and very knowledgeable individuals who are at the center of this discussion. In one corner, Frederick, who has had countless debates, discussions, and presentations on the issue. He is no stranger to the confrontation, and he himself has even captured images of space rocket launches, the ISS in transit, passing the moon, and many more. And in the opposite corner, we have the founder of one of the largest Facebook groups, and he also made headlines by confronting a NASA employee in a Starbucks, Nathan Thompson. This debate is brought to you by, of course, Non Sequitur. You can join us every Tuesday at noon for a brand new episode. That's on iTunes and your other favorite podcast platforms. This week, we are actually featuring an interview with Aaron Ra, who is no stranger to activism, barred approach. Now to explain how the debate is going to go and to give the rules, Steve McRae.
Hey, welcome. Hello, everybody. Steve. This is Steve McRae from the Great Debate Community and my own channel, YouTube, Steve McRae. Go ahead and check me out. What we're going to be doing today, we're going to be having a facilitated discussion between Red's Rhetoric, who has his own channel, Red's Rhetoric on YouTube, and Nathan Thompson. He has a group on Facebook called, can I give the name? Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
Awesome. Official Flat Earth and Globe Discussions. So this is going to be a little bit of a back and forth dialogue, starting off with an intro between each one. Red's Rhetoric is going to have 5 minutes to give an intro to himself. Nathan will have 5 minutes as well. Then they're going to give about a 5 or 10 minute little thing about why they think the Earth is round or flat. And then they're going to cross-examine each other and give negative evidence towards the other person's position and positive evidence for their own position. Red's Rhetoric has decided to go first. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to them. So, Reds, go ahead and take it away. Give a little bit of information about yourself and tell everybody who you are.
All right. Thank you. Yep. So, my name is Red. I run the YouTube channel Red's Rhetoric. I am better known as that ugly fuck from Florida because my face is the reason why a lot of people are sick nowadays. All right. So, being in Florida, that gets me really close to Cape Canaveral, which makes it a lot easier to collect my shill check, which for some reason I still haven't gotten. So I just want to say thank you all for watching this debate. But keep in mind, I hate using the word debate, flat earth. Because keep in mind, there simply is no debate. The round earth model can easily be proven. And the reason why it can easily be proven is because the model that we built around the sphere earth model comports with reality the best. It makes accurate predictions that anyone can verify for themselves. You don't need to come to me or anyone else for that. On the other hand, the flat earthers have tried to make many models that explain just the basics, and guess what? for just the basics of our everyday reality, they have failed on all accounts. In fact, the only way, if the only way to make your model work is to say that other people are lying, then you're doing it wrong. And that's what I've seen from many flat earthers. Hopefully today will be a different story. But what I will go ahead and present when it's my turn to speak will be a few things. One, that we have two pole stars, that equatorial telescope mounts actually work. Those are also placed on a sphere Earth model. That the angular size of the sun remains the same, which would be impossible in a flat Earth, like it or not. And also, like it or not, curvature has actually been observed directly. And so when it's my turn to speak, you will hear all of that and probably more. We'll see how that goes. So with that, I turn it back over to you, Steve.
Cool. I don't know if it's Steve's turn. I was going to do my intro. Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm just going to go. My name's Nathan Thompson. About almost 2 years ago, I started the official Flat Earth and Globe discussion. Almost 97,000 members in there. I've seen millions of posts and stuff people think proves the Earth is spherical. Yet I learned all the same sciences in school, the globe Earth test when I was in second grade. So you're going to be re-educating me on stuff I've already investigated and stuff I've already looked into. I also don't like the term debate when discussing this, because that assumes you know you're right and I know I'm right and we're going to convince each other. And it doesn't always work that way. So I'm hoping we can just have a friendly discussion. I heard some of your debate with Jaronism. I can't believe you're still going to use the Southern Pole Star argument, but whatever. So we'll just, you know, I look forward to the debate. And I hope it's friendly. And I hope everyone enjoys it. And it's informative. I'm going to try and keep it as intellectual and, scientific-based, not faith-based as we can make it. Because I know, Red, you like looking up and thinking looking up proves the shape of what's down, but that's not necessarily the case. So I'm ready whenever you are, Steve, or Red, you just want to go into your proofs for the heliocentric model. I'm all ears.
All right. Thank you, Nathan. All right, Red, so go ahead and why don't you give a brief overview of your evidence for a round Earth, not so much a heliocentric model, but the shape of the Earth. There's two different discussions there. So, Red, go ahead and give a brief overview of your evidence. He'll give a brief overview of his evidence for a flat Earth. Is that acceptable?
That sounds good to me.
Good. Go ahead.
Okay, so I guess the first bit of evidence I'm going to go ahead and show is the angular size of the sun. Now, the reason why I want to go into this is because, like it or not, by looking up, you can actually verify what's beneath your feet. And not only that, but the shape of what it is beneath your feet. You see, on a globe Earth model, we expect the sun to remain the same angular size throughout the entire day, opposite on a flat Earth model. So since I'm not actually going to give, flat Earth, at least not yet, I'm going to go ahead and show you my observation of the angular size of the sun, because it's actually quite awesome, at least in my opinion. So let me know if you're seeing my screen share, because my computer's been acting up and sometimes it just doesn't like to show what I like it to show. So hang on 1 second.
You are being presented now.
I am being presented? All right, good. Let's go ahead and do this. So
Yeah, you're good.
So this is a file. So let's go ahead and open this up. So this is a file with my observation of the angular size of the sun. As each picture was taken with the Nikon P900 with a solar filter. And each picture was taken on a clear day. The entire day was clear. One picture every 30 minutes, roughly. As we go through the entire day, you'll see it bounces around in frame. But the one thing that does not change is the size of the sun in the frame. And this is going from horizon to horizon. And there it is, dipping behind some trees. So this is the end of the observation here. Now, when you're actually looking at this, there is a question that you need to ask yourself. The question you ask yourself is, why is this the case? Why is it that the sun remains the exact same angular size throughout the day? Well, I'm going to go ahead and assert that it's because the law of perspective kind of works in the round Earth's favor here. Law perspective is simply alpha equals 2 times the arctan of G over 2R. Put very simply means that the sun is so far away that the shift in size is simply so small you cannot detect it. Flat Earth would be different, but we'll get into that later. The next thing I want to show is that curvature has actually been observed directly. Screen sharing again. You can go to Metabunk and look at the Lake Pontchartrain videos by Soundly. And you can see that here we see the transmission lines curving with the Earth as we would expect. And guess what? This was also taken with a Nikon P900. You can get them off of Amazon. And so you can see that the transmission lines curve with the Earth. Not only do transmission lines curve with the Earth, but so does the bridges that go either along or in the same direction as the transmission lines. And I'm hoping to go to Louisiana myself so that I can actually film this for myself. Explains what compressed perspective is and explains exactly how it works. You can read this yourself. And as you're going down, you can see that you can actually verify this yourself with some simple backyard experiments. Here's one with a pool cue. And a lot of videos that pretty much go along it, pretty much say exactly whatever it needs. So you can actually see that curvature has been observed directly. Now, I also have observed curvature directly, and I'm not going to play the video here, but if you want to, I'll bring it up on a link. I have observed ships disappearing over the horizon bottom first, as we would expect on a round Earth. Ships disappearing over the horizon has been seen since ancient times for people with good eyesight, but now that we have cameras that have absolute amazing zoom, this can be done by everyone, anywhere, anytime, unless it's raining or very foggy. And on a very clear day, I was able to observe this and see it. Like I said, I'll show you that later, but I'm going to move on to the next bit. Equatorial telescope mounts. Wolfie was very kind to post a bunch of videos explaining how a equatorial telescope mount works, and in fact has a reward out for anyone who can prove how an equatorial telescope mount works on a flat Earth. He is giving away a drone, a DJI Mavic Pro, to the first flat Earther that can actually demonstrate how it would work on a flat Earth, but we'll get to that later. The fact of how it works is that it has everything to do with your position on the planet and in your relative position to at which angle you have to view Polaris at, southern celestial pole. And because of how it takes geometry into account to explain how it works, it's a perfect verificator as to say that if we are going to use tools and equipment to make accurate observations, what model do I need to base that on in order to comport with reality? What we choose to reference is the round Earth model in that case as well. And with all that, I also wanted to say one more thing that not many people go on, and that is that there are a few places on Earth that you can go where you can see far enough objects away, like, for example, Chicago and the Chicago skyline mirage, as it was been, as one of the greatest proofs for a flat Earth. But one thing I wanted to say is that if the Earth was round, we would only expect those objects to be seen when atmospheric refraction or looming was present. If it was anything else, if it was actually flat, we would expect to see it all the time, but we simply don't. Why is it that only in certain circumstances we actually make those observations? You see, the fact that the horizon is there and at the distance relative to your height, your altitude, the fact that the horizon is there and that it exists and that comports with the mathematics of our spherical Earth shows that, once again, the round Earth is the accurate model to base everything on. And I could go more, but I'm going to leave it at that. I relinquish the rest of my time.
Awesome. Thank you, Reds. All right, Nathan, so what you're going to do is you have about an equal amount of time, but you need to give evidence now for your flat Earth position, and then you can go ahead and address what he has said, so and attack his position. But what is your evidence for your flat Earth, just like he gave evidence for his sphere Earth position?
Of course. Reds, I appreciate you taking the time to go into that. Evidence for the flat Earth is all around us. For example, if the Earth were round, the curvature of the Earth would be manifested in the physical landscape. So, but we do not see any curvature at all because the Earth's circumference is purported to be 24,901 miles around at the equator. That means the horizon should dip from sight at a rate of 8 inches per mile squared, okay? It's not 8 inches per mile. That's a flat line tilted. It's 8 inches per mile squared. So I stick with water. Water has no convexity. Water always seeks its own level because water is always level. It can't be anything but perfectly flat. There's never any convexity to major bodies of water, such as oceans, seas, or lakes. They're all perfectly level. There is tons of proof of that. You look at frozen lakes in Russia. They're over 300 miles wide. There's no hump in the middle. There should be thousands of feet of hump. At 100 miles, the curvature should be 6,660 feet. And we notice none of that. The curvature is 0 inches per mile squared. So a geographic range table from the U.S. Coast Guard is also something I like to reference. If you could just give me a second, I'll pull that up. The table establishes that an object at 200 feet above sea level can be seen by an observer at sea level from a distance of 16.5 nautical miles or 19 statute miles. If the Earth were a globe, the top of that 200-foot object would be 40 feet below the horizon from 19 statute miles away. So it's simple to do. You just do 19 times 19. Multiply that by 8 inches, that's 240 feet. So this is going off the purported globe-Earth model. I didn't make these numbers up, okay? So heliocentric priests told us the Earth's 24,901 miles around, and all the globe heads think it's proven by shadows 2,000 miles ago, where Eratosthenes used a 93 million mile away sun rays, which isn't what we observe at all, to calculate the curvature of the Earth. When that experiment works just fine on a flat Earth, take the sun from 93 million miles away and bring it in to where it actually is, 3,000 to 4,000 miles away, and you got something to work with. So not just that, forget the water. The land on Earth is measurably flatter than a pancake also. They took Kansas, shrunk it down to the size of a pancake, and used lasers to detect on a pancake than there is in Kansas. And so if all the water's flat, Kansas is flat, nobody's detecting any curve, boats do disappear bottom first. That's how they should disappear, Red, on a flat Earth and on a globe Earth. And so also, I won't get into your sun shrinking because I can demolish that. I think I got time to do that later. Proofs the Earth is flat as the horizon is always level and rises to eye level. I fly all the time. My company sends me on trips. I'm constantly asking stewardess and pilots about, you know, their equipment and what they're doing, but most of them don't know how their planes work. But forget that, they're just there to do a job. The plane pretty much flies on autopilot. But what I find interesting is not only is the horizon level, the FAA trains pilots on what's called a target generation facility. It's supposed to be the most accurate model of Earth because safety is paramount when escorting 100 to 200 souls in a metal fuselage 30 miles above Earth, okay? We can't have insurance claims for running into domes or calculating for curvature that actually isn't there. So the pilots are trained to fly level, and not only level or cruising altitude, flying, you know, parallel to a flat Earth. Software, they're not accounting for the motion of Earth, and they don't account for gravity. And that's on the FAA website. I can go ahead and link you guys to the FAA website later if you need. But also, the Earth is purported to be a spinning ball, and there's no proof of the movement. So I'm just wondering, you know, I know that they give us a lot of regurgitated contrivances from the heliocentric priesthood, such as snipers adjust for the Coriolis, or toilets spin different directions in both hemispheres, but I know numerous snipers. I've also been through the sniper manual for the U.S. Marines, and they don't use the spin of the Earth to kill enemies. So, and that's another proof that the Earth is flat. There's tons of emergency landing evidence that the Earth is flat, and the testimony of the stars. So if Ursa's ball spinning in space, and we're hurling through the universe, our sun's going through the universe at 450,000 miles an hour, which it's Mach 800. It's so fast you can't even comprehend how fast it. But yet we have a stationary North Star, and according to REDS, we have a stationary South Pole Star, and they've been using those to celestial navigate the oceans for 1,000 years. Now, why don't we see any movement in the Northern Star? And they'll just say, oh, it's 433 light years away. They can't. So they just made it up. So like I said, the proof of a flat Earth is all around you. You just got to open your eyes. And I can't wait to debunk all the points Red's brought up, because I got a couple notes here. So I'll just turn back over to you, Steve. Those are my proofs that the Earth is flat.
Okay, thank you very much. Red, there was a little bit of a negative evidence towards a ball Earth that he had come up with, but towards his evidence for a flat Earth, do you want to address those specific points, and then he'll address some specific more points towards the evidence that you've given?
Sure, we can go ahead and do that.
Thanks.
Let me know what you want to do, and I'm good for anything.
Yep, go ahead and address some of the points that he had made towards his evidence for a flat Earth.
Just let me know what. Do you want me to address them directly, or?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Okay, understood. Okay, so there was a lot to be said. The first thing I want to go ahead and is how once again the flat earthers make the classic mistake of confusing flat. Let me go ahead and debunk this, or I should say educate, because you used the word, so that's how I'm going to use it. Let's go ahead and look at this. Okay. Is that shelf flat? Yes. Is it level? No. Then why the fuck are we using these two terms interchangeably? Yes, water is level. It does find its level. However, level does not equal flat. Soundly's evidence that I just pointed to shows water being level with the pull of gravity. Yes, gravity is a thing. And because it is level with the pull of gravity, and the pull of gravity is curving with the Earth, that would make the water curve with the Earth. First point down. Let's go ahead and move on to the next one. Sorry if it goes on forever. Let me end it. There we go. All right, next. We have the claim that the sun's rays are not parallel. Therefore, the Eratosthenes experiment is basically... You know, how are you going to prove that these parallel sun rays are actually level? Well, I can do that very easily with, you know, the Nikon P900 again, and with a YouTuber by name of Wolfie. And on his channel, he actually is a pilot. And while he was actually flying a plane, he took the P900 during dusk or sunrise, I forget which, and looked at the shadows that the clouds were making. And guess what? The shadows of those clouds were perfectly parallel. This is videos that have been shot before, not only by Wolfie, but by other people as well. In fact, Wolfie has another challenge to say that if you're able to show how my videos are wrong, then go ahead and demonstrate it. I have a DJI Mavic for you too as well. This guy's just giving out drones left, right, and center, guys. So yes, the sun rays are parallel, and because Eratosthenes was able to make that observation, that is very strong evidence for around Earth. Next, the horizon rises to eye level. Does it? I fly to New York every now and then as well, and there's a little app that you can download called Ditropa. And at cruising altitude, if you were to hold the... actually, let me start on the ground. If you were to hold the phone up and put the horizon right at the crosshairs, you will see it'll be around 0 degrees. If you're flying up high enough, like cruising altitude, I don't know what the altitude was, but I saw my horizon dip by -3 degrees. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but -3 degrees would be below eye level. So if it was at 0 on the ground and -3 when I was at cruising altitude, and if I were to do the math and find out exactly what it should be at that altitude, and I find that, according to the globe Earth model, it would also be around -3 degrees, I say that this and that the horizon always raises to eye level is debunked. I'm going to need to actually see some sort of evidence, not just an assertion, that that has actually happened. And that's just as much of a criticism for me. So if you want to see it, I'll pull up the picture from Dai Chopra that I was able to take on my phone. I'll just have to plug my phone in. The next thing was that, let's see. Oh, the 8 inches per mile squared. That was not something that any round earther, or as you like to call the priests, came up with. That was something from Samuel Robotham back in the 1800s, and that is just a rough approximation to about 100 miles. And so with that, we can go ahead and use that. We can go ahead and use that and figure out what objects are a little bit further away. It does a good enough job, but one thing it does not take into account is the elevation of the observer. 8 inches per mile squared. At what point, where in that equation do we put the height of the observer? Do we not accept that the height of the observer is actually relevant to figuring out what objects are and are not going to be hidden? Oh, but wait, we can ignore that? Well, why? Every single flat earther that I have spoken to didn't even realize that they had to take the height of the observer into account, and that is actually important to when figuring out what objects are and are not going to be hidden by the horizon. So why are we stating it again here? The one thing that I would like is an actual equation that takes all factors into account. And until we get that, I can just completely ignore that equation because I realize and everyone else realizes that the height of the observer is actually relevant. So if you're giving me an equation that doesn't take that into account, that can be ignored entirely. And as far as the sun, we didn't really go into that. I think the Polestar thing we're about to get into, but I will go ahead and relinquish the rest of my time and we can go from there.
All right. Thank you, Reds. Go ahead, Nathan. You want to do a little rebuttal on that? By all means.
Yeah, of course. You said it's not including the height of the observer, but I just read you the geographic range table from the U.S. Coast Guard that totally is height of sea level, is visibility of distant objects from sea level. So they're telling you how far you can see if you're at sea level. So the height doesn't matter of the observer because you're at sea level. Samuel Robotham didn't invent AutoCAD, and he didn't invent Pythagorean theorem either. So all those can be used to calculate the alleged curvature formula of the Earth, which, again, is not something we observe in reality. But I want to jump back to gravity. Oh, because Earth's water is curving because of gravity. I love this. This is so good. So mass attracting mass had never been proven, and I can debunk it with quite a few things, but I just want to quote from Edward Hendry's book, The Greatest Lie on Earth, in his chapter Crushing Gravity on page 234. And heliocentric theory, the Earth is spinning at approximately 1,000 miles an hour at the equator. The Ball Earth scientists had a problem with their theory. How can you explain to people, animals, and things that they don't fly off into space due to centrifugal force? Dun-da-da! Gravity, right? Newton's theory of gravity is founded upon the premise that all objects are attracted to all other objects based on mass. That's never been proven. This magnetic-like attraction of magic objects gravity is purported to have can be found in the natural world. So I love how you try and dismiss my claim of flat water by bringing up gravity, a vain religious superstition, again, contrived by the heliocentric priesthood that's not observable in reality. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the formula for gravity, but it's got an inverse square law. And Reds, you're intelligent. I don't need to tell you what an inverse square law is, but let me tell all the listeners. The closer something gets to Earth, the stronger the pull of attraction should be exponentially. Okay? It's not a constant 9.8 meter per... Oh, wait. So it should be exponentially growing. So the farther you get away from Earth, the less of an attraction you should have with gravity. So something interesting happens no matter what altitude you're at. If you drop something, it falls at 9.8 meters per second. I think Reds will agree with that. That's pretty basic common knowledge. So 9.8 meters per second. Now, if you're an inch from the ground and you drop something, the gravity should be exponentially stronger than if you're a mile off the ground or, let's say, 30 miles in the air on an airplane. But we don't witness any of this inverse square law in reality. Also, terminal velocity. How do things reach terminal velocity if they're constantly being attracted by an exponentially growing force? It doesn't make any sense. So also centrifugal force. If the ball Earth is spinning, the amount of centrifugal force will decrease as you leave the equator and venture towards the north or south poles. Now, what else should happen? Things should weigh more as you leave the equator, but what we don't see in reality is things weighing more as you go towards the equator or things weighing less as you go towards the North Pole. And then they love to bring up how, oh, but if you remove all the air particles in a vacuum, the bowling ball and the feather fall at the same rate. Well, of course they did. What do you expect them to fall at different? They only should fall at different rates if mass is important, and mass is important on the globe Earth model with the gravity theory. So the fact they fall at the same rate and there's no horizontal gravitational attraction between the bowling ball and the feather in a vacuum, we only see things dropped. So I repeat, that's a vain religious superstition for what's keeping you on your spinning ball Earth when in fact the Earth is stationary. So earlier you spoke about the sun and how it doesn't go into a little dot when it's disappearing on the horizon. My friend, let me educate you about something called glare. It is well known that when a light of any kind shines through a dense medium, it appears larger or gives off a greater glare. So at any given distance when it is seen through a light. So what's happening is, I'm reading from Samuel Robotham's book. There's a chapter called The Cause of the Sun Appearing Larger When Rising and Setting Than at Noonday. It's very explainable on a flat Earth. I don't know if you've never ran into anyone who's told you about glare or the fact that there's air around us, but the air around us does things to things, especially lights. And the more air the light has to shine through, especially the sun, which is 10 miles wide, it actually increases in size. So let me see if there's anything I missed. You said, you know, oh, we know the sun's 93 million miles away, but I don't know, have you ever seen crepuscular rays? All the rays are converging to one central point above the Earth. So we don't witness parallel rays. That's another contrivance of the heliocentric priesthood that, oh, we have this massive ball sun that gravity attracts Earth to, and we go around in the solar system, and there's lots of other planets, and we're going to go there too. So, also, the horizon rising to eye level, when the gentleman on the Red Bull jump opened the capsule, the horizon was not only flat at 120,000 feet, the horizon was at eye level with the gentleman in the Red Bull jump. So, you know, just some things I wanted to bring up for a discussion. Hopefully that brought up some new thoughts for you, Red, but I look forward to what you got to say about all that.
Okay, hey, Reg, do you want to do more of a, just pick one particular thing that he has touched upon and have just a free form go back and forth as you see fit on a topic that you want to address specifically?
I could just do all of them real all quick and just, forward. We can see which one.
Okay.
Okay, perfect. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and address this thing one by one. So let's go ahead and take the motion of the sphere, which I'm going to argue is irrelevant. I can prove that very simply. Take a ball. It's a ball, right? Put it on the table. Is it moving? No. Is it still a ball? Yes. So why the hell is this an argument? The motion of that ball is irrelevant to whether or not it is a ball. So yes, I can go ahead and ignore that bit entirely. Let's move on. Yes, they are saying what it is by sea level, but I'm 6'6". My eye is never going to be at sea level. I have a tripod that's taller than I am. It's also not going to be at sea level.
You can't lay down or get in the water, Red?
Really? My eye, this is my turn to speak. Okay. My eye is never going to be at sea level, and laying down
never?
And standing
not even
up.
If you're in the water, Red? I'm sorry.
This
I'm
is
sorry.
My turn to speak.
That is so ridiculous. Nathan, we'll give you a chance to say you're never going to be at sea level.
Nathan, we'll give you a chance.
This is my turn to speak.
Yeah, go ahead, Ned.
You could lay down on the Earth.
This is my turn to speak.
Hang on, Reds, I got it.
This is my turn to speak.
Go ahead, Red. You'll never be at sea level.
Nathan, we'll have plenty of chance to do a rebuttal. Trust me. I mean, he's not over-talking you. He's not interrupting you. Please have the same courtesy and respect towards him. So let him finish his presentation on this, his argumentation, and his rebuttal, and then you can do the exact same thing. Okay? So, Reg, go ahead and finish, and then he can address what he was trying to say.
Thank you. And so what I was going to say is that while it's not impossible to make your observations lying on your, that's not going to always happen every single time. And yes, I've seen many flat earthers go out to the beach and do this observation. I don't see any of them doing this observation while lying flat on their face. So maybe we should invent a new rule. If you're a flat earther that wants to do observations of objects disappearing below the horizon, make sure you do that observation lying flat on your face. And until other people start following that rule, I have every right to call them hypocrites. Next, moving on. So the rotation and centrifugal force. You said that the Earth is spinning at 1,000 miles an hour at the equator, that gravity will either have to be so strong that it will crush you at the poles, or it's going to fling you right off into space. Okay, well, that is very, very good. Very good. Okay, well, the problem with that is that, and I am going to be screen sharing right here, I did kind of debunk that shit on September 8th of 2015. Went through the math, you know, I'm sure you're a smart dude, you know the mathematics as well as I do. You know Newton, you know what equation is by Newton, you also know how to calculate for a centrifugal force, and you know, F equals M2 times R times the product of 4 pi to the second over T to the second, T being time, of course, and we see that the difference would be 2.35 newtons. And what does that mean for the overall picture as far as your weight at the equator? Of 0.346%. Let me repeat that one more time. 0.346%. So no, you are not going to be flung off or crushed at the poles or flung off at the equator. It's not going to happen because we're dealing with a weight difference of 0.3%. If I weighed 150 pounds at the poles, I'll probably weigh 149 point whatever at the equator. Whoop-de-fucking-do. Moving on, let's go ahead and see what else we got here. Because I got a list. Okay, next we have terminal velocity. If we're dealing with a rate of 9.8 meters per second squared, why isn't it that things keep falling at a faster and faster rate? Why does terminal velocity exist? That's because of air resistance, my friends. Eventually, you will hit a point where the resistance of the air balances the pull of gravity. And that balancing point for a human at around, you know, doing a fucking swan dive out of an airplane, around 125 miles per hour, I've been told. So air resistance is the reason why there is terminal velocity. And that is why objects fall at different rates between, like, let's say, a feather and a bowling ball, not in a vacuum. Now, you mentioned that they do, in fact, fall at the same rate, which is great, but I want to know why they fall on your model. If gravity is not a thing and has simply been this bullshit story conjured up by heliocentric priests, I want to know what it actually is. What exactly is gravity? What causes those objects to fall? And if it's not the atmosphere because they're in a vacuum, put any directional influence on the objects that are falling, why is it that they choose to fall in the same direction and at the same exact rate? Please tell me why that is the case, good sir, because I, to this day, have yet to hear one single answer on what the hell it actually is. Next, crepuscular rays. Yes, I have heard about crepuscular rays, good sir. Not exactly ignorant, but according to your argument and according to your logic, that must mean that these train tracks are converging in the distance and are not parallel the entire way. So keep in mind that if we're using, you know, crepuscular rays as evidence that the sun is close, then that must mean that the endpoint of this of these tracks must be really close, all things considered. Parallel lines moving away from you are going to look like they converge in the distance. That is called the law of perspective. Law of perspective, once again, alpha equals 2 times the arc of g over 2r. Basically, oversimplified, it means as you're going to get further away, the trains are going to look like they're touching. Same thing with the rays. Just because the sun rays look like they are not parallel doesn't mean they aren't parallel. And so with that, I relinquish the rest of my time.
Okay. Go ahead, Nathan. Go ahead. Now you can respond to Red's there.
Yeah, sorry for interrupting you, Red. I just thought that was rather ridiculous to assume you would never be at sea level, as if sea level was some unattainable height. That was great. And I love how you talk about lying face first, you know, like, who does science lying flat on their face? I don't get it. But that was good. You know, you could always lay on your side or something like that, or just get in the water. But all right, cool. So I just don't understand how the entire ball Earth model is based on all this purported movements of the Earth spin and the Earth around the sun. And you ask a globe earther to prove all of that, and he says it doesn't matter. It's a ball. So I don't understand, you know, how you don't think movement is important. But one of the things that's interesting to me is that the movement's never been detected. Coriolis effect is, in fact, very real on spinning balls. If the Earth were, in fact, a globe, the Coriolis effect would be manifested. But, in fact, planes that fly north and south don't adjust for their flight path to account for any Coriolis effect. Hot air balloons that leave the Earth don't experience the Earth moving under them because of an alleged Coriolis effect. Quarterbacks, when they throw a football, don't adjust for the spin of the Earth because of an alleged Coriolis effect. So the Earth is stationary. I've seen no evidence to the contrary. And the fact that the entire globe Earth model is the fact that everything's moving, but you just dismiss it and say that's not part of the argument. I don't need to defend that. I just think it's kind of immature, kind of ignorant, kind of naive. So I want to hear what your best proof of movement of the Earth is and its alleged rotation around the sun, but also the sun's movement through space at 450,000 miles an hour, and then tie that into your stationary North Star and Southern Star for me, please.
I think that deals more with the heliocentric model than a flat Earth model.
It's the geocentric versus the heliocentric model. I mean, if you guys want to talk about the shape of the Earth, let's just only talk about the shape of the Earth. But, I mean, it's the model. I mean, why would we talk about the whole model? Because it's model that's so ridiculous.
Reg, yeah. you want to address that, and then I'm going to turn it over to Kyle for a few?
Well, here's the thing. The fact is that when I came in on this, I came in to discuss the shape of the Earth, not the movement of the Earth or even the movement of the sun. All right, all the evidence that I point to is pointing to the shape of the Earth, not its movement. He did bring up movement, you know, to ask, well, if the Earth is spinning, why not this? So I decided to answer it real quick, but that's not what I'm here for. I'm here to look for evidence on how people can be so sure that the Earth is flat, or how people can be so sure that the Earth is round. Movement be damned. As I said earlier in this debate, if you take a ball and throw it, it's a round ball that's moving. If you put the ball on the table and have it not move, it's still round. Motion is irrelevant in that case. If you're going to tell me otherwise, then please explain to me how that works.
We're talking about the globe Earth model versus the flat Earth model, Red. Your globe's alleged to be moving. Like, how do you not get that?
My globe is also alleged to have a rounded shape, and that's the only thing that I'm considering important, at least for this debate.
Your first proof was talking about the movement of the sun and how that proves we're on a round Earth.
Yeah, because the sun can actually tell us a lot about the shape of the Earth that you're standing on.
Yeah, so can the fact that it's not moving, and there's no proof that it's moving.
Oh, really?
You know what's funny is you already brought up gravity. If you can't prove the Earth moves, what the hell are we even talking about gravity for, bro?
The reason why I brought up gravity is to debunk your claim that, oh, level, flat, and this, that, and all the other stuff, and also bring up the sound wave thing.
Red, gravity is the reason why things fall on your model. It doesn't have anything to do with curving water or anything. It's the reason why you drop things and you're allegedly, you know, they don't fly off the spinning ball Earth.
But and
gravity not only has it not been proven, it doesn't make flat things curved. So my argument is that water is flat, and you bringing up gravity has nothing to do with flat water, bro.
And that's why I brought it up, because you're so ignorant on the topic that you don't understand that gravity actually does come into play when we're talking about water curving over a ball. Because the fact of the matter is that the pull of gravity curves with the Earth. If you have water on that surface, it will also curve with the Earth because water finds its level, as you admitted to. So if water finds its level, and level is defined as that being proportional with the pull of gravity, and the pull of gravity is curving with the Earth, the end result is that we have water curving. And if water is curving, we should be able to see it, which Soundly did at the Lake Pontchartrain, and this is why there's a metabunk for it. You can actually go to Lake Pontchartrain yourself with a P900, and Soundly, I know, would be happy to provide one to you, and you can see this for yourself.
You have done that experiment yourself, so how do you know for a fact I can go there and do that? And hey, buddy, lakes aren't curving. So all the frozen lakes in Russia are 300 miles long and they're totally flat. Are you saying that Lake Ponchananchon in Louisiana is the only lake that curves? Because that's not visible on anything else. Well, any other lake or any other body of water. There's bridges in China that are 102 miles. They're missing over 6,000 feet of curvature. So check it out. I understand that if the Earth were so massive we couldn't detect a curve, gravity would be a good reason to talk about, you know, how you think water's flat, but it's actually gravity, Nate. Blah, blah, blah. So at one statute mile, it should be 8 inches. At two statute miles, it should be 32 inches. At 3 miles, you're looking at 6 feet. So if you can see a grown man 6 feet tall from 3 miles away, that debunks the curvature formula right there. Not just that, you go 10 miles out, and you're looking at 66.6 feet of curvature, which I find is an interesting number. 666 has some religious significance. But let's say 10 miles is actually just 66.6 feet of curvature. That means any boat under 70 feet tall, pretty much any boat that's not a cruise ship, you can see from 10 miles out, debunks the curvature formula of the Earth. So I don't care why you think things cling to a spinning ball Earth. What I'm looking at is your purported numbers, and it doesn't match reality. So boats that are under 60 feet from 10 miles out, I've done the experiments. I grew up in Orange County, California.
And were you lying on your face when you did that?
I also went out to buy a P900. But you don't understand. I could see the whole boat and the wake hitting it. And even if you calculate in the 6 feet of observer height, which my tripod wasn't 6 feet tall, but even if you did, bro, you wouldn't be able to see an entire boat that should be missing from all the Earth's curvature in between. So you're saying being 6 feet tall is going to magically make 70 feet of Earth's curvature disappear, and I'm going to be able to see the whole boat? Man, bro, that's just...
I'm sure you have a lot of math to show me why 6 feet is irrelevant. I do. Would you like to see it? Because when it comes down to it, if you are lying flat on your face while making your observation and I'm over 6 feet tall, you would actually be very surprised to hear that according to numbers and according to reality, you know, welcome to reality, that actually pushes the tangent point of your line of sight back like over a fucking mile.
Okay, but the Hawaiian Islands can be visible from 100 miles away. You can see
if you are lying flat on your face, the tangent line is literally right in front of your face. If you stand up, the tangent line moves back from you. And at 6 feet, if you're talking about a dip of 8 inches over an entire mile, and I stand up 6 feet, what's the difference between 6 feet and 8 inches? It pushes the tangent line back over a mile on using your own mathematics. Your own mathematics show that not only are you not doing the observation properly, not only are you doing the mathematics incorrectly, you're showing everyone that actually this is exactly what we would expect to see on a round Earth. So if I'm to believe that you actually know what you're talking about when you're giving me all these numbers, data points, and observations that you have done with P900 footage or pictures that you have yet to show us on the stream, then please, you know, are you really going to blame me when I take a step back and be like, are you sure about that?
Okay, well, no? Okay. Let's take a look at the Chicago skyline and calculate the position of Chicago in relation to Grand Mir Park, which is the photography.
Please do.
Of Joshua, the one that famous picture that got on the news, and the newscaster actually had the audacity to say, what you're seeing here is a mirage. Gotta love those globe Earth priests. So Grand Mir Park is 600 feet above sea level. Lake Michigan is 577 feet above sea level. So Grand Mir Park is 23 feet above Lake Michigan. So let's assume the photographer was at the highest point in Grand Mir Park, and then let's add 6 feet for the height of the photographer. We come up with an estimate that the camera was at mere 29 feet above the level of the water of Lake Michigan. So we will subtract 7 miles from the distance of 57 miles to account for the 29-foot elevation of the camera above Lake Michigan. So Calculating the curve of the Earth using the 50-mile distance, we find that street level of Chicago should be 1,644 feet below the horizon. The tallest building in the picture is the Sears Tower. The Sears Tower was, from 1974 to 1998, the tallest building in the world, stands 1,450 feet tall above street level. However, the antenna on top of the tower brings the total height to 1,729 feet above sea level. So we're seeing all that, and it should all be gone behind the horizon. So I find that very interesting. And that took into account the height of the photographer, which is very easy to do, bro. You just plug in the numbers. You're smart. You know how numbers work. That putting in a 6-foot observer is not impossible to do. Just grab some AutoCAD. If you don't know how to use AutoCAD, I got a buddy who's an engineer in New Hampshire, Joshua James Bolero, and he'll show you how to use AutoCAD.
I really do appreciate that, but I actually have a different request. If you can please bring up objections that I haven't debunked on June 18th of 2015 going over the Chicago skyline observation. Let's go over it, shall we? So here we have the Willis Tower. It's no longer called the Sears Tower, by the way, just a little bit of point of fact. We actually go over the complicated geometry and go over the numbers and plug in exactly what we need to plug in order to find out how much of the tower should actually be hidden by the horizon when we're looking at this image. This is the image that you were referring to, the Chicago Skyline Mirage image. We took a look at the number of floors, took a look at its height, took a look at what the difference would be when it comes to the hidden by the curvature, which would be 56 feet in this case. And we were also trying to figure out that at what value would the atmosphere actually have to influence the light bouncing off of the Chicago skyline in order for us to actually see what we were seeing in the picture. And when we go through the math and we see, you know, what we need to see, blah, blah, blah. So let's go ahead and do a little bit of trigonometry. If you don't know trigonometry, I know a good guy that can help you out with that. And going through trigonometry, we see that we have a refractive index of 2.76. The refractive index of 2.76 actually gives us a value of 0.12 degrees. What this means is that the light from Chicago skyline, in order to be observed from the observer from across the lake, would be 0.12 degrees. Are you telling me that the atmosphere, being a liquid medium, cannot influence light by 0.12 degrees? That is a pretty heaven of burden of proof to bear, but hell, if you can prove it, I'll believe it. So please, tell me, is it impossible for light to be bent by the air by 0.12 degrees, where even flat earther agrees that things like atmospheric, you know, distortions actually do happen? That's you know, diffraction, deflection right there, admitted by other flat earthers. Are you going to disagree with them now? 0.12 degrees. How do we explain how it's impossible for that to actually be an influencing factor?
The whole entire skyline should be behind the curvature of the Earth. So I don't understand what you're talking about, light and 0.012 degrees. The whole thing should be
that gone. Means atmospheric. Then let me explain, because obviously I was not clear.
The atmosphere is magically bringing the disappeared horizon around the curvature of the Earth? Is that what you're saying?
So wait a minute. Are you saying that light traveling through a medium and being influenced by that medium is magic?
No, I already told you that's why the sun doesn't shrink. So I'm just trying to understand why you think entire skyline should be visible.
So it only works. I get it. I actually think I get it now. So the atmosphere can influence light only when it supports the flat Earth, but when it supports the round Earth, then we have to negate it.
Is the skyline a light? We were talking about lights, and it's very well known that when lights are being shown through a dense medium, they increase the size. So the skyline is a light, I don't know how this...
So when you're observing the skyline, are you observing the skyline directly, or are you observing the light that's bouncing off of the skyline? I'm wondering on how well your understanding is here.
You're looking at the skyline.
But not the light that's bouncing off the skyline.
It's not a mirage, okay? You're seeing the objects that are in front of your face, and those objects should be behind a curve, but there's no curve, so that's why you can see them.
Okay, so basically what you're telling me, just to make sure I understand you, you're saying light is completely irrelevant when looking at objects.
No, not at all. Not at all. And the air actually plays a part too, because if the air is denser, and that's
Let's focus on light.
You can't even see across the street because the air is so dense and so foggy. But so what are you trying to say, Red? I'm still trying to follow you on why we can see the entire skyline when the entire skyline should be behind the horizon.
Actually, a point of correction there. We actually couldn't see the entire skyline. 646 feet of it was actually hidden, and that is observed in the picture. I can go over the video again if you want me to. But of the portion of the skyline that we can see, the portion of the skyline we can see indicates that the atmosphere would have to influence the light bouncing off of the Chicago skyline by only 0.12 degrees over 55 miles of atmosphere. Because you're dealing with that much medium, you have a very small influence is actually possible. You having a very small influence, given the fact it has 55 miles of the shit to go through, is not only possible, it's what should be expected in some cases. And in that particular instance, when that picture was actually taken, it shows up. Not only that, but I also want to point to one thing that that picture also tells us, and that is the stretching of the image. If you superimpose a picture of the Willis Tower right next to the Willis Tower that is shown in that image, you will see that the proportions are completely different. The reason why the proportions are completely different is because the image is being stretched by the atmosphere. That stretching meant it stretched over the curve and allowed us to actually see it. What was the rate at which it needed to do that? 0.12 degrees.
So atmospheric magnification...
Atmospheric refraction.
What you're saying is
magnification.
Making it larger, it's expanding it. So that's
No, stretching. No, stretching. Stretching. Stretching is not magnifying.
It's getting bigger.
No, taller. Magnifying? Not bigger. Taller. Okay. Not bigger. Taller.
It's getting taller, so... It's not stretching it out. It's not magnifying it. It's atmospheric. So...
I can explain
it
again if you want me to.
So the air is making the building taller. All the buildings, or you can see.
Not the buildings. The light bouncing off the building is being refracted in such a way as to make it appear over the horizon.
So it's curving,
is the photons being influenced by the atmosphere they're flying through. It's the photons being influenced by the atmosphere that they are currently dealing with.
So the light is curving around Ball Earth and showing you almost the entire skyline besides a few hundred feet at the bottom, which, I mean, is just atmospheric magnification. You shouldn't expect to see street level from 50 miles away. That's ridiculous.
Atmosphere. Well, I would, again, correct you. Atmospheric refraction, but at this point, it's semantics. So if you want to call it magnification, be my guest, but just know my definition of it.
Cool. So yeah, my claim was the entire thing should be behind the horizon. I'm not convinced that light is bending around the curve of the Earth and stretching out the buildings, and that's why you can see it. I just go with, what's the most logical. And just like I mentioned before, water has. ...700 feet of hump in the middle of the lake. That's just ridiculous. It puts a giant smile on my face that people actually believe that nonsense. But it's not what mm-hmm. we see in reality. Lakes freeze over.
Even though we have a picture of it, we don't see in reality, but we have a picture of it.
You have a picture of a lake humping? I would love to see that. Pull that up on the screen.
Sounds like a plan to me. Let's go ahead and do this. All right, screen sharing in 3, 2, 1. And let's go ahead and bring this back up.
A frozen lake. Oh, you're going to go to that one lake, the same one that you used before?
Hang on, question. I have a question for you. Do you prefer moving pictures or still pictures? Because I have both. Which do you prefer? This is a moving picture.
Firsthand observations, that's not firsthand. But also, like, it's very easy to fake moving and still pictures. So I don't know
I would love for you to prove to me that this is fake. I would love for you to prove to me that this is fake, considering it's been done multiple times by multiple people.
Multiple times? Well, show me more than one video, Red.
This is the second. Oh, sure. We have, let's count the videos. All right. So we have one video, two video, three video,
wait,
four video, five video, six video.
Wait,
hang on.
Where are you going?
Hang on. Hang on. You asked me to count them, so I'm counting them for you. So what was that? 8? So we have 9 video. This is a
that all looks like GIF the same video, Red. You're counting multiple of the same video. So
and 10 video. Well, this one's no longer there, so I won't count that. Let's see. Okay. All right, so this is the end. So I would say about 10 videos of this one spot on different days that you can see actual curving water. So there you go. We can play each and every single one of them if you prefer.
You know, that's cool. You have one lake as an experiment. You did like 10 different videos on it. But what I'm saying is that all bodies of water on Earth, other than this one lake you haven't been to, Red, are measurably flat. And another example of that is the Suez Canal. It's irrefutable proof the Earth is flat. The canal runs for 100 miles, and there's no locks in the canal. It's perfectly level for the entire 100 miles. If the Earth were a globe, each end of the canal would necessarily be over 1 mile below the horizon from one end to the other. The middle of the canal would have a hump of 1,666 feet in the middle of the canal. So...
All right, so you were asking for observations that I have done myself, so this is my own video right here. So let's go ahead and play this video. So as you can see, you have the sailboat, blah, blah, blah. There's the time as it was when I was actually filming this. Nikon P900, people, thank you very much, Nikon, the flat earther camera of choice. As you can see, the flat earther camera of choice is doing an excellent job filming this ship, but look at that, it starts to disappear behind the horizon. Let's go ahead and see. We can see the actual captain of the ship. There it is. There's the awning above. Oh, look, the awning is now gone. The ship has basically been sinking. It's basically the next Titanic, all in slow motion, though.
Can you zoom in some more, Red?
And then here we have just a sail being visible. The entire ship has actually disappeared at this point, you know, for the reasons that we're discussing right here, right now. And when it gets to this point, it's pretty much just a tick on the horizon. This is observations I've done myself. 73,000 views filmed on May 12, 2015. If you want the full unedited video, the link to that will be in the description down below. This video is over 1 hour and 12 minutes of this observation from one camera, one point, and this exact sailboat.
Hey, Red, do you think boats should appear bottom first on a flat Earth or what?
No, here's what I expect boats to do as they're sailing away from you on a flat Earth. I'm expecting them to shrink in totality as they go further away from you. I do not expect them to arbitrarily disappear bottom first at an arbitrary distance. Because there's nothing
Red,
on the flat Earth model.
Hang on.
I'm not done yet. I'm not done answering your question. Here's the thing, the law of perspective is a thing, and parallel lines, like your line of sight and the ground, will not intersect by definition. The law of perspective states alpha equals 2 times the arctan of g over 2r. Again, all that means is that further away, it's going to appear smaller in your vision. There is nothing in that equation, the law of perspective, that states that objects heading away from you are going to disappear bottom first by a certain amount at a certain distance. It's simply not part of the rule. Yet on a flat Earth, we would expect to see all of it there and the law of perspective actually come into effect. But we don't. Something else is coming to effect, which is the curve, which is why not only are objects still visible, their angular size still well known, but they are disappearing bottom first, as my video just shown. And yes, I did film that on Tampa Bay, again, 2015. So we have Tampa Bay, we have Lake Pontchartrain. I saw another observation done from New York to New Jersey. So that's 3 locations down so far. I'm sure we can get some people from California if you would like to try it.
Right. I've done the same experiment. You just need to zoom in on the boat, bro, okay? If it disappears behind the curve, zoom in. It's still there. I've done the experiment.
I like how you said that because I actually did that in this.
You can see it disappear.
I actually did that here. So this footage right here.
Go ahead, Red.
Thank you. This footage you see here is filmed with a Lumix DMC FZ70. As we're going through the Lumix DMC FC70, I actually put that flat Earth claim to a test by switching to a different camera, as you can see here. So as you can see, there's one camera, as you can see, and here's the other camera, which is, what do you know, a Nikon P900, the flat earther camera of choice, people, which has a greater zoom than the DMC FC70. And even with the greater zoom, the ship is still below the horizon. So, good sir, if you can please show me a video of objects disappearing over the horizon, only to be brought back up again by simply zooming in, I would love to see it, because I've tested it, and as far as I can tell, that assertion is horseshit.
Real quick,
Red,
if you guys want
boats to, disappear bottom first on both models.
Well, we have a little
and,
break.
You fundamentally...
Do you guys want to do start a Q&A here really soon? I know Kyle has a question in the wings for you, or do you want to continue on this line of questioning?
We can do Q&A, if that's okay.
Okay.
Yeah, cool.
Okay. Kyle, go ahead. I believe you have the first question. Plus, I'm looking at the live feed. We have about 100 people live watching right now. If you have a question you want to ask both these people right here, Reds or Nathan, please put the question in the live chat. If there's not enough characters, you can message me on Twitter, Facebook, G+, email, by any means, get a hold of me, and I will try to ask you a question. But go ahead, Kyle, ask your first question, and we'll go from there.
I just have a question for Nathan. This is just, you know, personal, something that I've always wondered. Why the lie? You know, why lie about the shape of the Earth?
Yeah, well, it's the greatest lie you could tell. If you can convince people the floor moves 1,000 miles an hour, and that the Earth's a ball, but you can't see curvature, you essentially turn all the little 6- and 7-year-olds into really gullible people. And so they'll believe anything you tell them, and they'll eat anything you feed them, and they'll drink anything you give them. And so take the money equation out of your mind, because the elite own all the banks. They do not need more money. So yes, NASA steals $52 million a day of taxpayer money. It's larceny. It's wealth redistribution. If people knew the truth, they wouldn't allow it. But they're hiding God's creation. His characteristics and what he's like are clearly observable through his creation. So if they can confuse you and trick you about what his creation is and what you are, because globe Earth is the foundation for evolution, and so all these globe Earthers think they're shape-shifting monkey men that are on a spinning ball floating through space. I mean, can you think of anything more ridiculous to teach kids? Before they know the difference between boys and girls, and they don't even have hair on their balls. It's crazy that it's important for kids to know the shape of the Earth at 6 years old. I mean, it's such an indoctrination. It's such an obvious indoctrination. And they do it for, you know, to hide God and to hide. If they can convince you that Genesis 1 is stupid when you're 6 years old, why would you read the Bible when you're 7? Why would you read it when you're 8?
Red,
so all my proof here.
I'm sorry. I thought you were finished.
Yeah, all my proof here has been purely scientific. I don't have a religious argument for flat Earth. But when people ask why would they lie, you gotta understand the devil is the father of lies. So when you look at the curvature formula being 0.666 feet per mile squared, and the tilt of the Earth being an alleged 66.6 degrees, and the Earth moving around the Sun alleged 66.6 thousand miles an hour, I just find that all very interesting. And I'm sure Red would just say it's a coinky dink. But I don't believe in coincidences, and especially not when it comes to mathematics that are made up. You know, if they're all sixes and it's all made up and you can't prove it, there's definitely a conspiracy taking place. And you got the United Nations using a flat Earth map divided into 33 sections. Now, Reds, I don't know if you know why a cult of 33 would be important. I won't even ask you. But 33 is the percentage of angels the devil took down from heaven with him. So when I say all these elite that taught you the Earth's a globe and run NASA and give you all this heliocentric proof, worship the devil. And that's why they cut up a flat Earth map into 33 and they call it the United Nations, and they're united against us and us knowing the truth. And so that's why they lie, brother.
All right, let's give Reds a chance to do a rebuttal on that. Real quick, Nathan, if I may, real quick, you mentioned evolution. Are you a young Earth creationist?
A young Earth? I don't know the age of the Earth. No rock I pick up comes with a state-issued ID. I don't assume carbon dating and the rate that carbon dissipates has always been the same. I think that's faith-based science.
Okay. That's fine.
I really like to stick with things we can prove when I'm talking about, you know, what I believe in. But, you know, I do think that it's not billions of years old, but,
okay. You
know, that's just my belief. Okay, that's how I feel.
A little off topic, but thank you for my indulging on that. Reds, go ahead, and if you could answer Kyle's question as well from your perspective of why you think that the Flat Earthers put forth this narrative.
So I guess the question is, what do I think of their conspiracy?
Why do you think they've created a this narrative?
Well, it's because, I am just going to state the facts, is that they are pretty butthurt that science has actually advanced in the direction that it has, and that to a large number of people, that is driving people away from God. There is a religious influence on it, and so they will come up with anything to get people to question reality itself. Yes, I'm sorry. The fact is that, okay, I'll explain to you this way. This is a Falcon Heavy. The reason why this exists is because you can't pray shit into space. And that pisses off a lot of people. And the reason why it pisses off a lot of people is because God is supposed to be the answer to everything. Well, hey, if we find out that God actually got some things wrong in the Bible, holy shit, what does that mean for my faith? What does that mean for my religion? What does that mean for my eternal life? My salvation?
I was a Christian for like that.
It's like, holy shit. You know, you start feeling very uneasy about the entire thing. And so I can understand that they would be feeling uneasy, but my thing is this. If you want me to think like you, you need to bring something other than numerology, something that has no predictive capabilities whatsoever, to the table. You need to give me something to actually chew on, okay? And also, the great thing about the United Nations, why is it this particular map? Why is it in this way? I don't know. Maybe because they don't want to show bias to one side of the planet over the other. And so they decided to make a symbol that wouldn't show bias to one side of the planet or the other. I don't know. Just a fucking thought. I mean, if I was making the United Nations, which is all over the fucking place, I would include a map that does its damnedest to show, quote, all over the fucking place. I mean, but that is way too fucking reasonable, so maybe I'm just crazy.
Hey, Red, maybe you are just crazy, but I'd like to bring up what you said about, you know, science kind of disproving God and stuff.
I never said that.
Okay, well, I was a Christian for 10 years, and I was a globehead the entire time.
Good for
you. I didn't have any problem being Christian and a globehead. I didn't think that science was going to demolish my faith, that Jesus came and died for my sins. So I reluctantly became a flat earther. Nobody jumps on flat earth and accepts all this ridicule from their friends and family. And for me, major news outlets and celebrities making fun of me. I don't do that because I want to. Okay, it's a reluctant decision to become a flat earther. After a scrupulous look at, one, the fakery with NASA, two, the fact the Earth is obviously flat as a mother, and three, we are not moving through space, my brother. We ain't going nowhere. So you're here, you're trapped here inside a dome, and you're stuck here with a bunch of flat earthers, and we're multiplying exponentially, and you can keep digging your feet in sand. It's cool, bro. Believe whatever you want. But I've seen no proof of a spinning ball Earth. All your proof of curvature is you not understanding lines of convergence. And honestly,
as you saw with train tracks, right?
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny that you say the sun has parallel rays. But how do you explain the eclipses? Okay.
How do I explain eclipses? You're going to have to elaborate.
Are parallel rays working on with your eclipse model, because the path of totality, whoa, with parallel rays, Reds, don't know how that's working for you, bud, but I'd love to hear, since this is question and answer, how you're dealing with that.
Just fine. The sun makes light and the moon casts a shadow. That's how I answer that. But
so
hang on. I'm not done yet. You said a lot of things. Allow me to respond.
Yeah, cool.
So here's the thing. A lot of people will accuse me and other people of simply, you know, sucking on the teat that is NASA or what we've been, quote, indoctrinated to believe. But the thing is that I've actually done the one thing that many flat earthers haven't done, and that is my own fucking observations. When I went out there, I could not will that ship to disappear over the horizon. When Soundly went out to Lake Pontchartrain, he could not will that bridge or those power lines to curve with the Earth. When I did my angular sizeless sun observation, I could not will it to change. When I was using a solar filter which gets rid of the glare, I could not will the solar filter to all of a sudden produce glare. All of the things that I have done were completely out of my control. I simply observed what happened, and then I came to a conclusion based on those observations. And if NASA wants to go ahead and do whatever they want to do in space, so be it. But you'll notice a pattern here. The pattern here is that all of my evidence, all of my observations did not come from NASA, did they? I did not once go to NASA, SpaceX, Blue Origin, ULA, Boeing, or Sierra Nevada Corporation. I didn't go to any of them. For this debate, they can all get fucked. This debate is simply based on what I have observed, the mathematics that I have done, and the conclusions that I have come to based on those observations. And as you said quite elegantly, you see no reason to believe that you're on a ball. Well, fine. Based on the observations that flat earthers have told me to do, I see absolutely nothing pointing me to the claim that the earth is flat actually being true. I see everything pointing to the fact that there actually is curvature, that it is measurable, that you can see it if you would go out and actually take a good look and also not bury your face in the sand. And also, if you actually do the observations properly, do the math properly, you can come to the same conclusions I do.
Okay. And we have a couple questions from the live feed, if we can jump into those real quick. Sure. This question I'll ask to both of you, and would you please frame the answer with respect to your own model. I will ask Nathan first. First question is, how do you explain sunrise and sunset on a flat earth model? And if you have a model that can actually do this, is something you can point, we'll put in the video description afterwards.
Yeah, the sun sets and rises because of perspective. We can't see forever. The sun is small and localized, and the earth is large. So.
I'm not sure if that actually answers the question.
Why we have sunsets?
Correct. If you have a flat Earth model,
So the Earth is flat and the sun is going away from you. We can't see forever, so the sun disappears. It's perspective. No.
So, okay, let me try to reframe this. Why? Because I'm trying to get it in the way that it was probably intended to be asked. Why on a flat Earth model do we see the sun actually go below the horizon?
Because it's really far away. The laws of perspective. I don't understand.
All right, let me ask Doug Reds the same question. Can you frame it in the way from a ball Earth or spherical Earth, Reds, and at the same time, if you wish, explain would it work on a flat Earth, or what is he trying to say here as far as the perspective aspect?
Okay, so let me just make sure I understand. You want me to explain what the flat earther is trying to say, or do you just want me to explain why sun actually set on a round earth?
Yeah, both. Why we have sunrise and sunset on a round earth really quick, and then maybe parse out what he was trying to say as far as perspective on a flat earth model?
Well, quite honestly, I can't do the second one because I honestly think he might have a different definition of perspective than I do that has different consequences. So he's going to have to explain that one in a better way. But as far as my model goes, the reason why we have sunrises and sunsets is because the Earth is curved. The sun can only illuminate one half of that curve, you know, at a time, being that it's a sphere. And so as you come into to light, that would be sunrise. As you're dipping out of the light, that would be sunset. And again, so you have half of the Earth in darkness, half of the Earth in daylight. I can show up a diagram, which will probably help a lot of people, although I don't know why I should have to do that. But if you want to, I can. But yes, the reason why we have sunrise and sunset is because we have a round Earth. Light can only illuminate half of that planet at a time. There is a terminator line, and that terminator line gives us the sunrises on one side and the sunsets on the other.
I think it's a fair question to be asked about the nomenclature you're using here, Nathan. You said the word perspective, and I think for clarity's sake, can we kind of narrow down what your meaning of the word perspective is as far as the word use as you're using it in your argument?
Yeah, so as things move away from you, they become harder to see, and they also, if they're in the air, they come closer and closer to the horizon, and there comes a point with the lines of convergence that you can't see anymore. And so the reason that the sun sets is it's really far away. I don't know who.
Would that change the angular diameter of the sun as it recedes?
I went over that. I'll go over it one more time because it's well known that when a light of any kind shines through a dense medium, it appears larger. So not only does it's not staying the same size, it's getting bigger. But you want to get rid of that. Just increase your altitude, decrease your atmospheric refraction or atmospheric magnification, whatever REDS wants to call it. But sunsets, okay? Take a look at a yin and a yang symbol. It's the most vague flat Earth map you could ever look at, but we all grew up with it. We all know what a yin and a yang symbol is. The sun and the moon are rotating around polar center, and the reason we have seasons and sun analemma and 24-hour days in the north is because the sun's path is expanding and contracting annually, alternating every 6 months. And so, I mean, that's the sunsets for
Red,
you.
Do you want to address that? Yes. Okay, go ahead, Kyle.
I can address that only if the question is to address it. Like, how do you address that? So is that what you want to do? Because I don't want to step on his toes.
Well, real quick, I mean, he's actually advocating the position that if the sun is moving away from you, it should change the angular diameter. Your argument is that we don't see an observation of angular size change and that it actually does go below the horizon rather than just a receding point or a vanishing point. Is that correct?
Correct. Basically, the law of perspective is a mathematical equation. And basically, without saying it one more time, all it means is that if an object is close to you, it's going to appear at one size in your vision. As it moves away from you, it's going to get smaller in your vision as it goes away. Eventually, it's going to be so small that the available resolution of your eye will be insufficient to make out whatever the fuck it actually is. Now, the law of perspective is for the object in totality. That is the thing that I disagree with a lot of flat earthers on. Perspective, or the actual law of perspective, says nothing about objects disappearing bottom up. It says absolutely nothing about it. And so, if perspective was the reason that the sun goes away at night, what we would expect to see is the sun shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking to a freaking pinpoint, and then eventually the resolution of our eye be insufficient to actually pick it up again, and then come back into view again when it gets larger and larger and larger in our vision again, because it's getting closer again. In fact, what we actually see is that the angular size of the sun stays the exact same throughout the entire day, yet still sets, which means that the one thing that's causing sunrises and sunsets is actually not the law of perspective. Because the law of perspective, being an observable phenomenon, is not being observed when we observe the sun, as I have demonstrated earlier in this debate.
All right. Kyle, did you want to add to that?
I was just going to say something before you move on to the next question. While everyone's listening, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, we are featuring another debate, and that will be between G-Man and Pamela Whistle from the American Atheists. She will be coming to rebut G-Man's claim for years now that atheists do not exist. So join us tomorrow at 7 for that debate. And now, Steve, back to the questions.
All right, thank you very much. So there's a few questions in the live chat, but they're kind of I don't want to ask them directly. They're kind of framed a little bit odd. But how about do you want to ask each other questions? If you have questions of your own, Reds, towards Nathan?
Yeah, I got some questions for Reds still.
All right, why don't you ask your first question, then Reds can ask you a direct question of his choice.
Yeah, Reds, since they're trying to be so fair to all the continents, I found it interesting they excluded Antarctica, one of the entire continents, from the map. But that's not my question, Reds. I'm just wondering, on your model, how do you explain the moon being cold light, putrefying light, also having a blue color, blue hue to it, and the sun having a whitish yellow hue, giving off a hot light and being preserving, which is the opposite of putrefying? How do you guys explain that on the globe model?
I'm gonna need to ask you to clarify that question. What do you mean by cold light?
You've never heard of cold moonlight, Red?
I've heard of people messing up observations when they're trying to measure the temperature of the moon, but I want to know what you're referring to specifically.
So the moon, the light is putrefying. You can test that with meat or vegetables. It has the opposite effect that the sun has on meat and vegetables. which is preserving. It's how we make beef jerky is with the sun. You can't make beef jerky with the moonlight. It's an opposite kind of light. It actually causes all food to decay, which I think is actually part of the brilliant cycle of life God created. But what I'm saying, Red, is that moonlight is measurably cold. The shade will be warmer than the exposed moonlight. I've done my own test on a supermoon last year and noticed a temperature variation of 6 to 8 degrees between the moonlight and the shade. And I'm just wondering how the sunlight is getting bounced off the moon in your model and magically turning into a cold light source that's blue and putrefying.
I'm going to say I don't have an explanation for that because I assert that it doesn't actually happen. So you're asking me to prove something that I don't think actually happens.
Okay, can you pull up my test on the supermoon?
I won't be able to do that.
I'm not on a computer. I thought you were on YouTube earlier. But all right, well, maybe later, Red, you can go check it out. There's not just me, but there's hundreds of people doing a laser thermometer test. You can get one for $20. Mm-hmm. It's a lot cheaper than your P900. So just go ahead, grab one and test the moonlight and go ahead and figure out what's going on there. Maybe I messed up my experiment. But I'm pretty sure moonlight's cold. So.
Okay. Well, hang on one second. Let me do this real quick. All right. Open up the drawer. What is this? A laser thermometer. Let's see. All right. Let's go ahead and point this at the wall. The wall is about 6 feet away. All right. I'm getting 75.4 degrees. Now let me move it to my closet, which is a lot further away. 32.2 degrees. Wait a minute, let me look at the instructions here. Oh, distance from the point from the surface you're actually measuring actually plays a role.
I don't point the laser at the moon, Red. I point the laser at the ground. The
temperature of the object. Okay, thank you. I'll be sure to look into that test you did later on.
Cool, good stuff.
So, if I could, for the audience's sake, who may not know about quote cold moonlight, you're saying that the light energy that's being from the moon as a source or something along those lines, the photons actually reduce an overall temperature or kinetic energy?
Yeah, and since I'm going to assume you got really intelligent listeners, guys, I'm trying to figure this out because we can't send a cold light. Light or heat moves from hot to cold. Pretty much everyone knows that. So what I think is happening is the sun is giving off its heat and the moon is actually sucking that heat up. And so that causes the light from the moon to give off a cold moonlight. That's just my theory on how it's all working. But yes, moonlight, and this has been done by hundreds and thousands of researchers, especially in my group, can all confirm that laser tests and Red, we're not shining the laser at the moon and then shining at the ground. We're shining at the ground where the moonlight's hitting, and we're shining at the ground where the shade's hitting. And I'm not doing the test from super far away where the moonlight is. I'm just standing on top of the ground, pointing down at the ground, and then I go stand on top of the shade and point down at the shade. I welcome any of your listeners. This, for me, threw the entire heliocentric model on its head. Because on the heliocentric model, if moonlight is sunlight, moonlight cannot be cold.
All right, so you're saying, because of course, heat is, by definition, the transfer of thermal energy from a higher concentration to a lower concentration. You're saying that the moon not only acts as a thermal sink, but actually re-radiates it colder than the initial heat going in. So how is it radiating negative heat?
Pulling heat. Yeah, it's pulling heat somehow. So it's like a generator of some type. I'm not claiming to have it all figured out. I'm just throwing it out there because if you got really intelligent listeners, guys, get at me. My email is nathanppl@yahoo.com. I want to hear your thoughts and theories on what's going on with this, because I don't claim to have all the answers, but I want to figure it out, at least what we can measure and test. And a moonlight is measurably cold. There's no explanation for it on the heliocentric model. That's why Red just denies it or, you know, whatever.
Well, I think Red's is saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, Red's, there's just no such thing as cold light.
Here's the thing. Being that I have the luxury of being on a computer, I'll go ahead and utilize such tools. A buddy of mine by the name of Astronomy Live actually did this observation to go ahead and figure out exactly, you know, if there's any merit to this. And guess what? There simply isn't any merit to this. I will link his video in the description, or I should say I'm going to ask that you guys, the actual moderators and the owner of this channel, link his video in the description. And he does this observation, or I should say experiment, that the flat earthers have. There is no temperature difference, detectable difference, verifiable difference, or even everything that we were able to get on our thermometer was negligible. We're talking about like 0.2 to a 0.3 of a freaking degree here. So if you have something that's different than that, then please show it. But we will also allow people to make their own conclusions after they observe our attempt at verifying this flat earth claim.
That's great how you can pull up other people's YouTube videos, but you couldn't pull up mine. I'm currently traveling and I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, hanging out with some flat earthers. That's pretty much all I do is travel the country, but I don't have access to a YouTube that I can show everyone. But if I did, I'd direct you to my cold moonlight experiment, which is noticeably different than your cold moonlight experiment where you couldn't detect. Hey, I just welcome all the listeners. Go grab a $20 laser thermometer. Test it for yourself. What's the worst that can happen? Well, shoot me the result.
I will put your video. Once this is done, I'll put your link in there as well, Nathan. And then I would ask that people that want to do this experiment do so by both methodologies. Cool. They can do it by Astronomy Live's method, your method, and then see for themselves if there's such a thing as cold light. I also would like to see more of a documentation for my own personal thing. I would read upon that from a physics standpoint.
Yeah, and just for your information, Kyle, if you magnify the light from the moon, you'll never get an increase in temperature, not even by 1 degree. So if the moonlight is in fact sunlight, they have these giant lenses that are 36 inches in diameter, and you have to hold it 4 feet above the ground. You can concentrate all the light from the sun or the moon into one point. It never increases 1 degree. I don't know if you want to go through more questions from the live feed.
Well,
I want to know
your question, then Nathan, and then so Reds has his, and I have one or more question from the live feed. So Reds, you want to ask a specific question towards him?
Sure. So my question to you is, please explain to me how an equatorial mount works on a flat earth.
Reds, I don't know anything about an equatorial mount, so I can't help you there. I want to know, I got a question, if I can ask a question.
Hey, can I just ask a different question since you don't know anything about equatorial mounts?
Yeah, that's cool. Fair. Cool. Yeah, please.
I think I deserve at least one answer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Ask as many questions as you want, Red. I'm here to chat with you, bro. If you have questions, that's great. I mean, it's really honestly better than hearing you regurgitate crap I've already heard, because I've heard all those proofs.
The feeling is mutual, which is why I was bringing up videos I made that answer your questions back from 2015. So my question is that if you're going to talk about, like, let's say the law of perspective and stuff like that, is there any numbers to your definition of perspective or no?
Yeah, I'm sure there are numbers. I'm just, you know.
But you don't know what they are.
No, I don't have the numbers for perspective in front of me.
Okay. Have you ever had – do you utilize those numbers for perspective when you're doing your observations or no? Or do you find them unneeded?
I don't need what you need numbers for to determine what you're seeing, because you can clearly see that things are flat, and you can clearly see that the sun disappears behind the horizon and actually has a green flash, which if you understand prisms – I don't know if you understand prisms, Red – the green flash on a sun proves the sun is still above the horizon. It's just really far away, because if the sun were dipping below the horizon, the green flash would actually appear flipped on the bottom of the sun. So have you ever heard a green flash argument, Red, or is that all new to you?
I think it's time for me to ask questions, but just so I can sum up your answer here, your answer is no, I don't use numbers when referring to perspective. I find them unnecessary. Is that fair to say?
No, not at all, because you're calculating sight distances. Numbers are all very important. I just don't understand what you're saying about the perspective formula. What can you elaborate on that for me?
What the law of perspective is?
Yeah, go ahead. I mean, what am I missing here?
Well, I'm not saying you're missing anything. I'm actually trying to determine if you're missing anything based on your answer.
Okay, well,
so
what should I be using in my experiments regarding perspective?
Okay, well, here's the thing. I'm asking you if you do use anything. If the answer is no, then that answers my question. So I guess I should...
Do. No, I do. I use your alleged curvature formula. I use distances from the observer. I use height of the observer. I mean, we've been going over numbers all day to think I
I'm
just...
I'm just talking about one thing here. Let me rephrase the question. when you are referring to the law of perspective, just the law of perspective, what formula, if any, do you use?
Oh, I don't know. I don't understand the question. I'm sorry, Red.
Let me see if I can facilitate this then. He's asking you for an actual formula that you can show us that you're using for your evaluation of your experiments relation.
Yeah, of course. The alleged curvature formula of the ball Earth is 8 inches per mile squared. So if you can see things that not are alleged question. To be that's, behind the Earth's curvature formula.
That's not his question.
I mean, I don't understand.
He's asking.
That's not my question.
There's various formulas just that you use in optics, and there is things relating to perspective, especially dealing with isomorphic transformations and matrix. But what is he's asking you? Which one of those formulas are you using to?
I don't even know what an isomorphic transformation is, Kyle. I'm sorry.
So. I'm Steve, but that's okay. People get us confused all the time. We're so much alike. I'm trying to rephrase this in a way that again, that Red is asking it in a way that the audience can understand as far as perspective. He's just asking you what formula are you using? He's asking for numbers.
I'm using the purported globe-Earth formula, 24,901 miles around, to see distances
that's not a formula,
that should be behind a curve.
That's a figure, not a formula, and that's revolving around curvature, not perspective. Let me try this again, but let me break it up, okay?
Please do.
Okay, so I'm going to try to ask this in a different way. For the definition of perspective, do you define perspective as a mathematical formula or not?
Perspective is how things disappear as they move away from you. I'm sure there's a mathematical calculation for it, just like there's a mathematical calculation for everything in the universe we observe, except for this globe Earth purported numbers that we've been going over. So
I'm going to ask you to stay on topic here. So to answer my second question then, when you are referring to perspective, or when you go out and do observations where perspective is important, you do not take into account any formulas in your observation.
What perspective formula should I be taking into account, Red?
Alpha equals 2 times the arctan of g over 2r, where alpha is the angular size of the object, g is the actual size of the object, and r is the distance to the object.
Cool, sounds good. Never heard of the formula.
Never heard of it. Actually, that answers my question very well, actually. Right. Perfect. We can move on.
Glad you questioned.
Hey, Red, I got a question. I got a question for Red.
Okay.
So all
wasn't
these thousands...
Wasn't it supposed to be from the chat?
Yeah, well, let me do a quick follow-up. It's okay. Make it a very quick question.
Sounds good to me. More.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so we're...
Quick question.
They're ball Earth's alleged to have thousands of satellites, and you go and record these launches all the time, and I'm just wondering, what are all these satellites... And of course, they're attracted to Earth because of gravity and... That's how that all works. They go 17,000 miles an hour. But what are you guys doing during meteor showers, bro? You guys just take all the satellites down? Or are they calculating for meteor showers decades in advance with these satellites and where all the rocks are going to be?
What exactly is your question?
Yeah,
they doing with satellites during meteor showers?
Okay, so
do they calculate for...
Your
they calculate for all
that...
this movement in space dozens of years in advance before they send the satellites out and before Elon sent this car on a billion-year orbit.
Read his question. His
they
question
know
is
where...
assuming that these things get struck by meteor showers. I think that's his question.
Are we talking about, like, space debris?
Satellites.
Meteor showers would be like space debris, yes.
Okay. So here's the thing. Satellites are... basically a certain size, and also the sphere of influence around the Earth is also a certain size. What is the percentage of area that satellite takes up? A pretty minute amount. If a rock is going to be, if it's equally probable that a rock or a piece of space debris or space junk or whatever is going to be entering that sphere of influence, it is more likely that it will not hit anything rather than more likely that it will hit something. Now, it's not to say that objects haven't been hit by meteors in the past. We have pictures of solar panels actually getting bashed to shit by space debris. In fact, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter actually recorded itself being hit by something. You can even hear a little ding when it happened on its onboard recorder. So yes, objects are in space. There are satellites that are in space, and there is a risk with putting objects in space given space debris. But the chances of being hit by something are not so astronomical that it is impossible for satellites to be up there for days, years, or even decades at a fucking time without being hit by something.
So your answer is space is big.
My answer is that space is big. Satellites are small.
Okay.
So they just don't factor it in. Got you. All right, cool.
Yeah,
thanks, Brad.
I think cool. What he's basically saying is that space, there's a lot of area around space, and the amount of area that satellites take up in proportion in relationship to that is very, very small and minute. They do get struck, but it's not a very regular occurrence.
Yes,
so while they send these satellites into space, they're calculating for the gravitational pull of the Earth, the gravitational pull of the moon, and the gravitational pull of the sun on all these different satellites and their orbits, and just saying, "Ma, they take up so much space, and space is so big that they won't get hit by rocks." But they do sometimes. But what I don't understand is these satellites get hit by rocks. Isn't that going to send 100 satellite shrapnel into orbit? And isn't that going to cause a very big problem for all the other satellites that are in orbit?
Because most meteors are about the size of a grain of sand.
Okay, but you correct. Hit something going 17,000 miles an hour. I don't care the size of that object. It's going to – and so you're telling me that going 17,000 miles an hour and hitting a grain of sand isn't going to completely demolish a satellite?
Well, we could
actually, that's exactly what I'm going to say. No, it won't completely demolish the satellite because kinetic energy values are a thing.
Okay. Well, thanks for your answer, Red.
And kinetic – thank you. Can you explain for the audience, if you will, the relationship of kinetic energy to mass and using kinetic energy formula so they have an idea of why a speck of dust or sand is not going to impart too much energy on a collision?
Yeah, kinetic energy equals 1/2 of m times v to the second. M would be the mass of the object, and v would be the velocity. If the object is, you know, has a very light mass, m, once you decrease m, you also decrease e as a consequence of that. So a grain of sand is going to have very little energy to actually transfer to the satellite to cause damage. The mass would have to be a certain value. The velocity would have to be a certain value in order to go past the structural integrity or the tolerances of the satellites that are in orbit in order for it to actually do anything. And with it being just a grain of sand or dust or whatever, it hitting something, it simply doesn't have enough energy to transfer to the object to cause damage to that object.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Assuming they're all the size of a grain of sand. Okay. Got it. Cool.
Which we never said they were, but, you know.
Just many and most of them are. Okay. So the next question is by a natural astronomer. He says, why does the rate of the Foucault pendulum depend on the latitude of the observer? And either one of you can take this.
That's called petitio principii. He's begging the question. I've never seen proof that a Foucault pendulum is dependent upon the latitude that it's installed at. But what I do want to know is why nothing hanging swings all over the place if that's such a great proof of Earth's movement. And also, who starts the Foucault pendulum? And also, how do they explain an Elias effect? Because a Foucault doesn't work during an eclipse. And, eclipse doesn't have anything to do with Earth's movement. So just wondering if you could touch on that for me.
Reg, you want to touch on that then?
Well, answer the question that was asked by the audience?
Yes, please, first, yes.
Okay, then I'll start with that. Foucault's pendulum basically, an oversimplified view would be to bring the pendulum to the top of the axis, so the North Pole. So if you're at the North Pole and you let go of the pendulum, as the pendulum swings from back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, the Earth is going to rotate underneath it. So for somebody that is actually on the Earth, it's going to look like it changes the direction of its precession. So eventually in a 24-hour period, it will spin that precession round one time. As you get away from the pole, it's going to change it to a certain limit. So you'll see it dip this far, and then you'll see it dip that far in the other direction by a certain degree. And that is dependent on your position to the Earth. The best way to explain it would be to look at a model of it actually in practice. In fact, you can build one of these yourself. I did in high school, and it worked out just fine. And to answer the question of how you actually start one of these damn things without introducing any biases. I will say it is rather difficult, but notice the word difficult instead of the word impossible. The way people usually do is that they simply tie it to an anchor point and burn the string off, thus not actually introducing any side-to-side motion that would influence the result.
Well, something I got that completely throws that on its head is a gimbal base from a gyroscope placed on a table shows no movement for the spin of the Earth. If the Earth were spinning, the gimbal surrounding a gyroscope would show a movement of 1.25 degrees every 5 minutes and 15 degrees every hour. So such an experiment has been performed, and it's never shown. Have you ever heard of a gimbal base and a gyroscope proving the Earth is stationary, Red?
I'm actually concerned here. Do you know what a gimbal is?
Okay, I'm talking about the base of a
word gimbal.
That's what they're called. I don't know what gimbal you're talking about, but a gyroscope with a base. Okay. Red, I just want to know why a gimbal base, which is the mount for a gyroscope, doesn't spin with the spin of the Earth, just like you're alleging this Foucault pendulum is causing all this movement because of the spin of the Earth. I just want to know how come that instrument that you have to manually start and stops during eclipses, the only experiment that shows movement. Why can't you put a gyroscope on a table and witness the movement of the Earth?
Oh, boy. Okay, so just to make sure we're clear, you said gimbal base, right?
The base of a gyroscope.
The base of a gyroscope. Okay, the
reason around the gyroscope.
Because it's the base. That's because it's the base. If you're asking, does the gyroscope itself actually move around? That's why I wanted you to elaborate, but you didn't make that correction, so I'll make it for you. The gyroscope actually does move around. It's just that you need a sensitive enough gyroscope to actually achieve that. And in fact, you can actually get them, and that observation has been done. And to show that, I have to find the paper that I was actually given. I don't have it on me just yet, but at the very end of this, I will send it to Steve and Kyle to put in the description of this debate. But yeah, to answer your question directly, it has been observed multiple times, and it's just that the pendulum is just a very easy and relatively cheap way of doing it that results that we are in fact moving, and that it is dependent on your position on the Earth.
Shows the results you want. Got it.
We have no influence over the results. It swings the way it swings, and no one's been touching it since.
So you haven't explained Elias effect, but also if you could touch on the north, and since you claim there's a southern pole star, how that Earth going 66,000 miles an hour around the sun, and the sun going 450,000 miles an hour through the Milky Way, and then the Milky Way is also purported to move somewhere between 300,000 and 1.5 million miles. I'm just wondering how we get stationary stars because of all that movement.
The reason we get
Well, let's make that the last question, because that actually was from the live feed as well, and I'll address it to Reds. How do you get certain polar stars? Is it that you can see Polaris from the northern hemisphere, however you cannot see it from the southern hemisphere?
Okay, so there's two parts to this. One, space is also very big, and also space is also, those objects are very far away. So in order for us to move away from them and with any normal change, we don't have to go a fuck of a long way. And here's the thing. The reason why they stay above the same part of the sky, and the reason why the southern celestial pole stays upon the same part of the sky, is because those stars are actually observable. If they're observable to naked eye, that means they're inside the same Milky Way. If they're inside the same Milky Way with a one direction of rotation, as we know the Milky Way spins, would that mean that the stars are moving with us? Which means relative to our perspective, they wouldn't be moving? Holy shit, I think we figured it out, guys.
Okay, so everything's magically being dragged. I mean, I don't know how that makes sense on a Big Bang at all, if you know everything's just perfectly locked in place and moving with us.
Very interesting. I disagree with your term drag, because if you're driving next to a car that's driving at the same speed as you, it's not moving relative to you. Are you dragging the other car along with you, or is it simply moving at the same speed of you at the same direction? The Milky Way is a plane of stars rotating around a celestial point.
A plane of stars? So planes are flat. So
Yes, the Milky Way is a plane of stars. No, I'm not saying the sky is flat. I'm saying the Milky Way has a plane of stars.
Okay, but there's no parallax, so I think it's flat.
Okay, what is parallax? Do you know what parallax is?
Yeah, it's the measuring the distance of movement of stars away or towards Earth.
Not away or towards Earth. That's not parallax.
Or their movement in relation to other stars. So all the constellations.
I'm not really what parallax.
That's not parallax. Okay, let me rephrase a question. I can tell you what parallax is without bringing in stars or astronomy or anything like that. My challenge to you is to do the exact same thing. Tell me what parallax is without bringing in stars, sun, spaceships, or any of that shit.
Are you still with us there, Nathan?
Yeah, I'm here. Oh, okay. You know, I don't know. So I don't claim to know everything. I'm here to learn.
If you're not aware of it, you want to explain to the audience. I'd love you to teach me things. What parallax
so
would
much,
be then?
You know,
all right, yeah. Okay. Parallax is an effect where the position of a certain object seems to differ relative to the background objects based on your position to it. So, for example, if you hold your finger in front of your face and you look at its position relative to a spot on the wall with one eye, if you switch to the other eye, you'll see that its position changes relative to the object or the feature on your wall that's further away. That is what parallax is.
Exactly.
So have you heard of Halton Arp?
Halton Arp? Or
You mean the astronomer?
Yeah, the astronomer. Mm-hmm. They called him the modern Galileo. He used to work under Edwin Hubble as his assistant. Have you heard of him?
Not very familiar with the name, but I'm sure I could be.
Okay. Yeah. Well, while he was compiling a list of peculiar galaxies, he discovered that high redshift quasars are commonly associated with or even connected by filaments of lower redshift galaxies. Since the Big Bang requires that differences in redshift place the objects at different locations, astronomers commonly reject his claims, but if he's right, there's no Big Bang.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. That's a different, completely different topic. That's dealing with Big Bang. We can definitely have another topic, and I will get you another interlocutor.
Dealing with stars.
Well, hang on. Let me say this. The Big Bang is not the topic of the discussion. I would be happy to even do that debate with you, I think. Or I can get somebody like Hugh Ross, Dr. Hugh Ross, in, who's an astrophysicist, or we can get Landon Knoll, who's an astronomer. I think that's a completely different topic, but we would love to have that as a secondary follow-up with you, if that's okay.
Yeah, no, it's totally not my area of expertise. I'm all about verifiable, repeatable evidences that the Earth is flat and stationary. So that's why I jumped on this debate. I thought
it's just a different
topic. That's what I really.
Yeah, and like I said, we'll be happy to get you other interlocutors for that, because I think it's a little bit off topic from the shape of the Earth. The Big Bang has no relevancy to the actual shape of the Earth.
So wait. So on a globe Earth, how's a globe Earth created? I just would like Red. How do you think globe Earth was created?
Oh my God, accretion. Okay, so if you want me to go ahead and go into this, by the way, I just want to preface this by saying this has absolutely nothing to do with the original debate, but I will go ahead and answer that question. But you are going to have to listen to me ramble.
Yes.
Okay, so you had a batch of gas and dust that eventually over millions and millions of years collapsed in on itself under its own gravity. Towards the very center of that, you had a very dense collection of gas.
Where'd all those materials come from, Red? Please just start with that.
Let me finish.
That was not part of your original question.
Are you going to rephrase the question?
How did globe Earth come into existence? Are you just saying that all the materials were just there in space?
I am going to answer that question, but it requires your participation in order for me to answer that question. And the way you're going to participate is to actually shut up and let me answer the question. So let me go ahead and try this one more time.
Yeah.
So again, you had a collection of gas and dust. That gas and dust eventually collapsed in on itself due to their mutual gravity. As you compress objects, you drive the temperature up. It is a simple law of chemistry. Eventually, that gas and dust collapsed into a dense enough sphere where fusion could occur. And then our star.
It's not what I was asking. I really don't.
Hang on.
If you ask a question, you have to let the other person actually answer. He's allowed you to answer. Please allow him to answer.
He's starting with materials. Okay. Where did all
Let me finish, please. If you want to rephrase the question after the fact, that's perfectly fine. But I'm going to answer your original question first.
That's cool.
So, after the star was made, what was left over was an accretion disk of also gas and dust. And the solar wind blew the gaseous material further out, leaving the more rocky material behind. These lumps of grain, gas, or yeah, grain, gas and dust eventually collapsed in on itself to form like 100 or so planetesimals. These planets fused in together to create bigger planets and bigger planets. Eventually, their gravity forced them into a state of hydrostatic equilibrium, which has the effect of having a rounded shape. Essentially, all that means is that once an object has a certain amount of mass on it, it will form itself into a sphere as a consequence of that, since that is the most stable shape to have with that amount of gravitational pull. And so after that, you had multiple planets. You had Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, rocky planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, which were the gaseous planets, all form into spheres because of that is the state they have to be in order to be hydrostatic, in order to have hydrostatic equilibrium. It's the same effect for the Earth. So to answer your question, in a very simple way, the Earth acquired enough material so that its gravity can force its shape into a state of hydrostatic equilibrium with the effect of having a rounded shape.
Does that answer your question, Nathan?
Yes, the gravity god did it, the one that's never been proven. Mass attracting mass has never been proven. I already told you that attraction should be stronger the closer things get to Earth. And that's not what we, not what visible. Gravity did it. I counted the number of times you said gravity, a bunch of times. So gravity does everything, even though we can't prove it. And that's how the Earth was created.
I want to make sure I get this right. Nathan, did you just say that mass does not attract mass?
That's never been proven correct. Yeah. All objects with mass are not attracted to other objects with mass.
Hashtag Cavendish experiment. So
have you repeated that?
Actually, yes, I have.
Yeah, I think it's been
FSU is a place. And also going on from here, I have a follow up question to that.
Okay.
Why do you think I have an original question and a follow up question to that, if that's okay.
So my
whatever you
question,
want,
you can ask one question. That's fair. But go ahead.
Okay. So here's my question. It has been asserted by flat earthers that the reason why objects fall is because of density. We're denser than the air around us, so essentially the air is the gravitational, or not the gravitational, but the
pressure.
The air is the influence that forces objects to fall towards the ground. If we were to put objects in a vacuum and get rid of the air, therefore getting rid of that directional influence, why do objects still fall?
Because you picked it up and dropped it, Red. Okay?
Perfect.
So.
Cool. That totally answers my question.
The Earth isn't spinning, so there's no magical force that needs to bring things down towards Earth. You pick something up, you let it go. If it's not a helium balloon...
So your answer is it falls just because.
No, it falls because you dropped it. Okay, but not everything falls.
So just because.
You get a helium balloon and let go of that. That doesn't fall.
So. Here's the thing. If a helium balloon could actually survive the internal pressures of a vacuum, then actually, yes, it fucking would.
Are you also using the same definition of density as he is? I'm just going to clarify that. I want to make sure that Nathan is using the word density the same way you are as mass over volume or unit volume.
I hope so, but in reality, it breaks away from my original question. I asked why things would fall in the vacuum if we get
why
rid
wouldn't
of...
they? You remove the if air get... particles. All you did was remove air particles from under the object.
Because
so
the assertion...
air particles.
The reason why is
magically make things float or magically make things fly away from a flat Earth. Like, I don't understand what you think would happen. Boats disappear bottom first. Objects fall, even if you remove the air particles underneath them. I mean, it's pretty basic stuff. I don't.
Yeah, the confusion is twofold, because if flat earthers are the ones asserting that atmosphere actually makes the directional influence and we get rid of the directional influence, then yes, you actually do need to explain why objects fall when you get rid of the directional influence that you assert is the only directional influence on the actual fucking object. So yes, I too am confused. So if your answer to that question is because you dropped it, I'm pretty sure you not only answered that question, but a bunch of others that other people have had in the live chat.
So if you had two objects in a vacuum and they had really strong gravities, would they orbit or would they collide?
Two objects in a vacuum. You're talking about in space, in nothing space, right?
So yeah, like just like the galaxy, right? I mean, if you had a bunch of big objects in space, and obviously the Earth's big enough to have a gravity, right? I mean, everything in space has gravity. Why aren't they attracted to it? Like, when you say things fall in a vacuum, mm-hmm. the gravity of Earth attracts it, and then it gets stuck to Earth on the ground. So why basically, aren't any planets stuck to Earth on the ground, Red?
Okay, let me explain it to you. Imagine you have a ball, and you let it go. It's going to fall and hit the ground. Okay? Now take that same ball and throw it sideways. It's going to curve and hit the ground, but it's going to be further away from you. Now let's go ahead and go high enough so we can get above the atmosphere, and let's hypothetically say we can go Super Saiyan 3 on this motherfucker and chuck that shit really fucking hard. What would happen? The ball would always be curving towards Earth, but what if the curve of its arc matched the curve of the Earth? The ball is always falling towards Earth, but the Earth is curving away from it just as fast. The only reason that satellites and shit aren't constantly colliding into Earth is because they are in orbit. Basically, all that means is that their sideways momentum is such that they balance themselves with their outward radial velocity and the pull of gravity.
Did that make sense to you, Nathan?
Yeah, my phone's about to die. It got a huge glitch on it.
We're going to be wrapping
this up. Hey, Red, calm down.
Soon.
Everything's going to be okay, bud.
We're going to be wrapping this up soon. I just want to make sure that answer is fine for you. He's basically explaining to you how an orbit works, basic orbital mechanics.
So yeah, things in space orbit, but everything gets attracted to Earth and sticks to Earth. Got it. It's just
not
magic.
Not sticks. He said that an orbit is something where it is falling at the same rate at which the rate of the curvature of the Earth is equal. So it's in constant.
So this giant solar system has this huge cosmic dance, and everything's perfectly orbiting everything, and nothing ever collides.
No, actually, shit does collide all the fucking time. And in fact, if shit did not collide with other shit all the fucking time, I'm pretty sure the dinosaurs would be a lot happier right about now. I'm pretty sure the dinosaurs would be a lot fucking happier right now. Hang on. The reason why the dinosaurs got fucked up the ass sideways with no lube is because the one thing that you're asserting doesn't actually happen. Actually, it does happen. Shit collides with other shit in space all the time. In fact, there was a video of an observation made, I should say, of shit colliding with Jupiter.
Shoemaker Levy 9.
I can show you that video. Shoemaker Levy 9. Yes, thank you very much, Steve.
Yeah, so all the craters on the moon are perpendicular to the moon, but the moon's face is always facing Earth. So are those teleporting past Earth and going straight towards the moon, or how are all those craters perpendicular? I'm curious your answer on that.
I don't know what you're asking.
I don't know what the question is. So
all the craters on the moon, there's no slide-in craters. They're all perfect circles like pop pimples, okay? So, but what's funny is the face of the moon is locked facing the Earth, so... did all those rocks just whiz around the Earth and then fly straight at the moon? Or did they go through the Earth and go straight at the moon? Or how are those craters working if things are constantly getting hit in space by everything because of gravity?
Simple. It's because when meteors actually hit something going, a metric fuck ton of speed, they explode on impact. They explode on impact. They're not going to maintain their shape enough to slide, dude. When you smash into something going 4.7 miles per second, are you really going to be in one piece enough to slide, or are you going to explode on impact? I'm curious.
Now, Reg, they do have chambers for this, correct, where they actually do high impact projectiles into various mediums like sands, they think of
exactly
for like the moon.
There is a gun. There is a gun in existence that will fire an object, a really small object, into a tray of sand at 5 miles per second. And guess what it makes? Even though it's shot at an angle, a circular crater.
Okay. Right. Thanks, Red.
I know your phone is dying, so let's wrap this up while we still have you here available before your phone dies. Since Red's actually started, Nathan, why don't you do your quick closer, and then Red's excuse me, can close after that.
Yeah, that was great. I appreciate everything. And everyone, I encourage you to do your own experiments. Go test that moonlight. Water has no convexity. It's been an honor. Thanks for having me on your show.
Okay, that's it. Okay, thank you. Yes, appreciate sir. It. Yeah, no problem. Reds, go ahead. Do your closer.
All right, in closing, we've heard a lot today, but one thing I'm going to assert that we have not heard is any sort of evidence that proves a flat Earth. A lot of the supposed claims of flat Earthers that you can't see curvature, that, you know, you can't detect angular shift because of glare or Chicago skyline mirage and everything like that, all that stuff has already been debunked, one, by Soundly, two, by me doing actual observations, and as far as the Chicago skyline, by the acknowledgement that the atmosphere is a thing and that geometry and math is also a thing. When you want to go out and do your own research, I imagine, or my recommendation, I should say, is that you should do something else along with that. Learn the math. Learn the methodology before you do the observation, because if you don't have the methodology down, your observation accounts for shit. And with that, thank you very much for watching and have a good night, people. My channel is Red's Rhetoric, and you can subscribe if you like rocket launches and ISS transit videos. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Rich. I want to appreciate both you guys for coming in and having this discussion. I know that there's a lot of ongoing discourse between flat Earth and sphere Earth right now. I think that both needs to be brought out. I obviously do subscribe to the round Earth model, no question about that, and I'm not trying to hide any biases at all here. However, I think that both parties, you know, came in and they put forth their evidence and evidence against the other model according to what they believe to be. But I want to thank both of them for coming in. I wanted to put the links in the video description afterwards. I want to thank my partner Kyle here, who I'll be turning over to in a second if he's still there. Thank you for joining the Non Sequitur Show podcast. We are on iTunes, on Stitcher, and many, many other feeds. I want to direct also to the future debates that we're having. We're having Geranism on the 22nd on my channel, which is Steve McRae on YouTube, again, in the video description. Also to the Great Debate Community channel, we'll be having after shows and other things related to these types of discussions with people such as like Landon Kurt Knoll, who is the astronomer in the live chat who was asking these questions. He's frequently on that particular channel. So with that, I will turn it over to Kyle if he has any other announcements he wants to make. And thanks again for watching the Non Sequitur Show channel. And Kyle, take it away. All right, I think he'd have to go for a while. So we're going to end it with that. Hey,
real quick, yeah, if you could, yes. The official Flat Earth and Globe discussion. You there?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. By the way, please promote your Facebook community one more time before I end the stream, and I will put the link
guys,
to that.
It's called the Official Flat Earth and the Official Flat Earth and Globe Discussion. There's almost 100,000 people in there. You can get in there and add all your friends, even if you're a Flat Earther, even if you're a Globe Earther, and we'll get to the bottom of this. So let's figure it out together, whatever it is.
And we did post in there, and they are aware of this particular video. They will be coming over to watch this, and again, let them know they can join the Great Debate community at any time. The link is in the video description. It's a G+ community and multiple platform community with Discord and other things where in real time we can talk about these discussions. So if you have anybody in your group that wants to come over to the Great Debate community and have these discussions in real time, pretty much 24 hours a day, we have means to do that, and we'll have multiple videos going on, multiple platforms going on, and we'll probably have eventually a 24-hour live feed from the Great Debate community Discord. So that's something they can come in and do anytime if they wish to. Okay.
Cool.
Awesome. All right. Thank you very much, guys, for listeners. I appreciate all the 100 people watching. I'm sure this video will get thousands and thousands of views, and we look forward to your comments. And from Kyle and myself from the Non Sequitur Show, we wish you a good night.